From Katanning to Harrisburg, Countersport to White Oak, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, public sector labor unions in Pennsylvania benefit from a wide range of special legal privileges, and those privileges come at the expense of worker freedom. Nathan Benefield of the Commonwealth Foundation is here to explain. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is on track to end the fiscal year with a substantial budget surplus. How did this happen? Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi provide answers on the Allegheny Institute report. And as the United States Senate considers confirmation of another Supreme Court justice, judicial philosophy should be a key question. So says Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Nate Benefield of the Commonwealth Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. According to the Center Square, some state healthcare regulations temporarily suspended to adapt during the COVID-19 pandemic may become permanent. Legislation making its way through the State House of Representatives would, among other actions, relax regulations for telehealth measures and allow physicians from other states to provide services in Pennsylvania. The bill's prime sponsor, State Representative Jeff Wieland of Lycoming County, says the past 2 years have taught us, quote, some of the regulations are outdated. The changes are also designed to help lessen the severity of healthcare worker shortages. An update to state budget projections by the Independent Fiscal Office shows optimism over the future health of the general fund, espoused by Governor Tom Wolf, is not merited over the long haul. In the short term, though, the IFO's projections found the governor's analysis to be accurate. But locking in higher spending would turn a general fund surplus of $6.8 billion this fiscal year into a deficit of $12.1 billion by fiscal year 26-27. Wolf and the Republican-controlled legislature are currently debating the state's new budget, which must be approved by the end of June. It has been a long, controversial, and chaotic process. But this coming week, the stage will finally be set for the May 17th primary elections. With the state Supreme Court putting the final district maps into place, candidates for state senate and state representative have until Monday to file enough signatures to get on the ballot. Candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, United States senator, and those running for Congress have already completed their petition period. In the meantime, voters in three state House districts, two in Allegheny County and one in Luzerne County, will go to the polls in about 2 weeks for special elections to fill vacant state House seats. And Pennsylvania finally ranks in the top five, although this is a dubious distinction. The Keystone State is a place where you are most likely to be bitten by a dog. California has the most dog bite claims in the nation, followed by Florida, Texas, New York, and then Pennsylvania. Of course, all five are among the most populous states in the nation, so Fido might not be totally to blame. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Labor unions in Pennsylvania enjoy a wide range of special legal privileges that give them political and legislative clout, but all of this limits the freedom of government workers. Other states have enacted reforms to increase worker freedom. Nathan Benefield is Senior Vice President at the Commonwealth Foundation. He is here to sort through all of this. Nate, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Nate, when we look at public sector labor unions in Pennsylvania, they benefit from a number of very special legal privileges. Tell us a bit about those privileges.
Sure, Loman. There's a few things that government unions have in a law that give them special and unique privileges and political power. One of them is collection of political money. No other entity can use taxpayer resources, public resources, to collect political money or do politics on the public dime. But government unions have in contracts that the state and school districts will collect their political money for them and send those checks right to the unions, both in terms of dues, but also even direct PAC contributions are collected at taxpayer expense. There's a couple more privileges. One is like they can keep employees trapped in the union. There was a Supreme Court decision a few years ago that said that employees, government employees, can't be forced to join a union or pay a fee, but unions are not required to tell workers of their rights. They also aren't required to let them resign their union outside of a certain window. So oftentimes, public employees, teachers, state workers, if they want to actually leave their union, they have to wait 3 to 4 years and resign during a special 2-year window.
A number of years back, we had the landmark Janus decision, Nate, by the Supreme Court of the United States. When you talk about workers wanting to leave a union, it was my understanding that Janus made it unconstitutional to require somebody to belong to a labor union in order to have a job. How are the labor unions getting around that?
Well, it is that the Janus ruling said that the government employee, you can't be forced to join a union, you can't be forced to pay a fees to a union. They had been in place before that, what they call fair share fees, that even if you didn't want to be a member of the union, you still have to pay about 80% of that in fees. The way the unions are somewhat getting around that is, one, they're not really telling workers of this right. Most employees, when they're hired, they get a stack of paperwork on their first day, just as they do in the private sector. Here's your payroll deductions, here's direct deposit form, here's insurance form. Oh, by the way, here's the form for union membership. And it's implied that you have to sign up for it. So a lot of employees sign up without knowing any better, and then they have very strict, to be able to get out, very strict things put into contract about when they can actually resign their union membership if they want to leave. There's been many cases in Pennsylvania about that issue, about allowing workers to resign at their will that haven't quite been resolved. They're still putting that provision into a lot of contracts.
As a taxpayer, why should I be concerned about this? What is the impact on public policy that affects the average taxpayer?
Yeah, well, this is where these special privileges give those union executives great power and influence, and use it for political activity. And we've tracked, Commonwealth Foundation tracked more than $160 million in political spending by government union executives in Pennsylvania just in the last 15 years. And that's supporting candidates for office, but also lobbying for more higher taxes, more spending, against things like charter schools and educational choice, against things like pension reform, which is really driving up property taxes, even against privatizing our state liquor stores, which are controlled by government unions. Most Pennsylvanians think, hey, we should be able to buy alcohol at the grocery store like every other state. But it is the public sector unions executives who are fighting that policy using these political monies collected at taxpayer expense.
A number of years back in Wisconsin, there was at the time a Republican legislature and Republican governor, Scott Walker. They passed something called Act 10, which addressed many of these issues. Can you tell us a little bit about Act 10 and what impact has it had in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think a lot of people might remember this when Wisconsin went through this a little over 11 years ago, pushing Act 10, and there was tremendous protest at the Wisconsin Capitol in Madison, and indeed even union people breaking into the Capitol, storming the Capitol, occupying it for weeks.
You mean an insurrection?
Something like an insurrection, but very destructive. There was a lot of property destruction within the Capitol, and then the Democrats in the legislature left the state. They didn't even want to, instead of just voting no, they said, hey, let's try and leave, prevent a vote from even happening by going to Illinois and other states to get out of the state. Eventually, they did have a vote, passed Act 10, and this was this is going to be the union leadership said this is going to be a disaster for Wisconsin, it's going to be the worst thing ever, and we decided, let's take a look now, 10 years later, what the impact was, and Wisconsin's in much better shape. We can see that after they passed Act 10, which limited some of the union privileges in Wisconsin, they had also were able to pass tax reform, they were able to balance their budget at the state level, at school district levels, advance educational opportunity. And Wisconsin, their economy is much stronger. Their academic performance, school performance is much improved. Basically, across the board, Wisconsin's in much better shape financially, economically, and in terms of education in the 10 years since they passed Act 10.
We are talking with Nate Benefield, Senior Vice President at the Commonwealth Foundation here in Pennsylvania. So Wisconsin passed all these reforms, Nate. Your research shows that they have had a strong positive impact on the economy, the business climate of the Badger State. So coming back to Pennsylvania, What needs to be done here in order to put us on a more solid economic and policy path as occurred in Wisconsin?
We think adopting some of the reforms that Wisconsin enacted in Act 10 in Pennsylvania, mimicking that, we call it, you know, strike at the root of bad public policy, enacting good public policy. But in terms of public sector labor reform, it does include paycheck protection, like that we should stop having taxpayers collect union political money or any political money for any private organization. Taxpayer resources should not be used to collect political money. Second would be allowing public sector employees, government workers, school teachers, to leave their union at any time. It should be up to them. They should have the option. If they want to join a union, fine. If they don't, they shouldn't be forced to, and they should be able to leave if they're unhappy with the direction of the union. And the third is regular union re-elections. This is something they did in Wisconsin Act 10 that we don't have in Pennsylvania, that a lot of unions were chosen back in about 1970. 1970s were a lot of these public sector unions were certified. So a place like the school district, Harrisburg School District, they voted to elect the Harrisburg Education Association, which is part of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, which is part of the National Education Association. But that was happened in 1970. There's been no election since then. So really you have no teachers who have been in place, been working for 50-plus years. All of the current employees had no choice in who their union was, who represented them, certainly no choice in who their state and national unions were. So putting that up for election every few years, allowing the employees to choose their own union, choose which union represents them, if they want to be part of the national union or if they want a local union only, that should be up to them, and requiring those regular elections the same way we have for president, governor, state representative, and so forth.
So we have labor unions who are getting political dollars collected using taxpayer resources, and it's very difficult for members to get out of unions despite the Janus decision. The labor unions, what do they do with this money that they collect? I would assume that they are very involved in elections, but do they also lobby the legislature for policy issues?
Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, the public sector unions have become political operations that have their campaign contributions and have their lobbying arm. We identified at one point 80 lobbyists in Pennsylvania, you know, registered in the state capitol, who are up here lobbying for on behalf of government unions, and often in support of things like tax increases, in support of, you know, more government spending, and against things like competition and choice in education or other aspects that would, you know, free the private sector.
In terms of these reforms that your policy paper has pointed out we need in Pennsylvania, Nate, are there bills pending? Is there legislation that is being considered by the General Assembly in Pennsylvania to address these issues? And if so, where does it stand?
Yeah, that's correct. There's actually four bills that were advanced out of the House Labor Committee addressing a lot of these issues around transparency, around notifying workers of their rights, and about paycheck protection of collecting of the political money. They advanced out of committee on a party line vote. There actually been a hearing a few weeks before that, actually having public school teachers testify on behalf of this legislation. The Democrats ironically stormed out of that hearing, thought, didn't even listen, didn't want to hear school teachers talk about why the union was working against their interests. But yes, there is some good legislation on the move. Hopefully that can continue to move forward in the legislative process this year.
We are again talking with Nate Benefield. Nate is Senior Vice President at the Commonwealth Foundation. And Nate, tell us a little bit about the Commonwealth Foundation.
Sure. The Commonwealth Foundation, we are a research and advocacy organization working in Pennsylvania to advance free market ideas, free market policies, so that all Pennsylvanians can flourish.
And if we have folks who would like to read your recent report, give us the title of the report and where can they go to find it?
Sure. The title of the report is called Why Pennsylvania Needs Wisconsin-Style Government Union Reform, and that's on our website. Our website is commonwealthfoundation.org.
Nathan Benefield, Senior Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Nate, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
It is rare state government ends a fiscal year with a large surplus, but that is the case this year. To examine how this came about, we turn to Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi for this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. As spring approaches, so does the end of the fiscal year for the state of Pennsylvania. Believe it or not, it's going to wrap up June 30th. And your most recent brief states that Pennsylvania might actually end this fiscal year with a surplus. Mm-hmm. How would that happen? Can you give our listeners an idea of what's going on and what you've examined?
In February, Governor Wolf came out with his last budget for fiscal 2022-2023. He was specifying that his folks believe that they're going to end the fiscal year, which ends at June 30th of 2022, with a $3 billion budget surplus. He wants to spend a few of those dollars. You know, of course, we have extra money. We got to spend it. So his general fund budget proposal for the upcoming year is going to be $43.7 billion, up about 13% from last year's budget of $38.5 billion. You know, he wants to spend a lot of that money on educational programs that will have some lasting effects on the Commonwealth going forward. But one of the things that we wanted to look at is, you know, where did this money come from? And we did notice that when you look at the total general fund revenues, there's an anomaly. There's an anomaly in November. In November was the American Rescue Plan. In that plan, the Commonwealth received $3.8 billion from the federal government. There are some strings attached, but not a whole lot. For example, it is to replace lost public sector revenue. You have to have you have to spend it on things that happened after March 3rd, 2021, obligate them by 2024, December 31st, and then spend them by 2026, December 31st. So it's pretty wide range. One of the things that we'd like to caution the governor on is that's a one-time deal. That $3.8 plus billion dollars that came through is one time, but it was enough to mess with or offset the numbers for fiscal 2021-2022 because it was basically manna from heaven, so to speak, even though we know there's no such thing. And so, you know, we got back, we looked into the numbers, and it's a little difficult because as everyone's well aware, the pandemic really played havoc with the economy, and some of the numbers are a little off, but, you know, we tried to get down to the bottom of it.
Let's talk about the two main revenue sources that the general fund collected, the sales tax and the personal income tax.
Right.
Where do those two revenues stand? How do they compare to the year before?
The largest source of general fund revenue for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is the personal income tax. And of course, this is one that you've got to be careful with because of pandemic. In April of 2020, when the pandemic was sort of at its height, the state and the federal government both postponed collections of that tax until July. So that slid money from fiscal 2019-20 to fiscal 2021. And so it moved things around a little bit. So when you look at 2019-20, the pandemic only impacted mid-March, April, May, and June. As a result of that deadline being moved, the amount collected that year was 9% lower than the previous year. However, when you look at the next fiscal year, 2020 to 2021, it was up again because that deadline was moved. In July of 2020 had a much higher rate of collection than it normally would have had because of that postponement. As far as the collections go, going forward. So in the current fiscal year, so far averaging about $1.23 billion, which means we're on pace to hit $14.8 billion, which is 9% less than last year because of the movement of the deadline, but it'll still be the second highest amount collected in the last 10 years. The question is, why is that so high? And one of the answers, of course, is, well, there's inflationary pressures. What I mean by inflationary pressures, I mean wages. Wages are forced up because businesses were forced to raise their wages. And so when we look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data on Pennsylvania, and we looked at annual average hourly earnings, and that's wages plus benefits, in 2019, that was $26.16. By 2021, that was $28.37. That's an 8% increase in earnings just to entice people back into the labor force. And we've all heard the stories of having to raise wages to get people back in. We all saw the help wanted signs all over the place. So you had an increase in wages that, of course, filtered into the increase in personal income tax collections for this past year, and that's why they're running a little bit ahead. The second biggest one is the sales and use tax. And this is where inflation really becomes an issue, because as we all know, the 6% state sales and use tax is predicated on the price of the product. As inflation kicks up the price of the product, it also kicks up the sales tax. And that's just for the general state at large. You get to the Philadelphia and Allegheny County, where there's the extra percentage for, you know, and here in Allegheny County, it's a regional asset district tax. That's an extra 1%. So sales tax collections are certainly running higher than they would have simply because of inflation. And right now we're looking at 11% higher in fiscal 21-22 than we had in the previous fiscal year. And it's probably going to continue to go as we hit monthly records of, what, 7 to 8% inflation nationally. It's going to keep those taxes going. The question that the governor needs to think about and consider is, what happens when this all comes to a halt? What happens when the federal government wants to control inflation and start, you know, tightening up the money supply? When that happens, those tax revenues are not going to be as robust as they happen to be this year. So his desire to spend now, that's one time. What happens going into the future when that money's not there? Do we have to raise rates somewhere else? We've seen this before. You get these one-time gifts that are given out, and those receiving it thinks it's going to keep going on and on and on, and then they start pressuring their legislators to make sure it goes on and on and on, and that's just not fair to taxpayers overall. We have a concern with his overly generous, hey, let's give this money to education, because what happens when that $3.84 billion is not there? What happens when inflation comes back? Then these recipients of this tax money are going to get angry and cause problems for whomever's next in office.
Frank, great stuff as always, and we encourage our listeners to visit our website, www.AlleghenyInstitute.org, to read this brief and other work that deals with the coronavirus, that deals with budgetary matters, and we'll be watching as the fiscal year proceeds. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Judicial philosophy should be one of the key considerations when the United States Senate is considering confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary.
On March 1st, Americans for Prosperity congratulated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson on her nomination to the Supreme Court and urged the Senate to carefully evaluate her qualifications, including her judicial philosophy. Americans for Prosperity Foundation's Policy Counsel, Eric Bolander, set out to answer what Senate Judiciary Committee members should be looking for in a Supreme Court justice and what makes a good judge. And a few characteristics come to mind. Some focus on aptitude, education, experience, intellectual rigor, understanding of the law. Others on character, temperament, fairness, compassion, commitment to justice. I doubt anyone can seriously quibble with this statement. A good judge is impartial, understands the law, treats all litigants fairly, and seeks to ensure justice is done in any case. Many judicial nominees fulfill these requirements. Those that don't should be rejected out of hand. But there's another critical element, judicial philosophy. This is the toolkit judges apply to every case. All judges should have and be able to articulate a judicial philosophy, how they plan to do their job. There are two primary schools of thought here, living constitutionalism and originalism and textualism. Let's start with living constitutionalism, which asserts that the meaning of the Constitution, or even statutes, should change over time of the amendment process. This flexible approach, which allows judges to change the meaning of the Constitution as they see fit, leads us down a perilous path of judicial activism. That is where a judge might look at the case or who is on what side and decides what the right outcome is. This doesn't mean the objectively correct outcome dictated by law, but instead what that judge subjectively thinks should happen, morally, politically, or otherwise. The judge then twists the law whichever way is necessary to decide as he or she sees fit. This isn't how the law should work. Litigants should come into a courtroom expecting judges to leave their personal views at the door and simply apply the law to the facts of the case. Judicial outcomes must be grounded in predictable, even-handed application of the text as it was understood when the law was made. If the law needs to change, and very often it does, that's the job of the lawmaking branch, our elected members of Congress. That's where we come to the other major school, originalism and textualism. Under this approach, a judge's job is to give the plain text of the law and Constitution the meaning it had when enacted, and then faithfully apply that to the parties before the court. This approach recognizes that it's the legislature's job to enact new laws or even amend the Constitution, not the job of unelected judges to change the written text. And while these concepts may sound basic, they undergird our entire legal system. They ensure that every litigant gets a fair shake and that each branch of our government is responsible for its own job. Judges' jobs are to enforce the plain text of the law as written, leave their own views at the door, and treat every litigant fairly. They should never engage in legislating from the bench. That's for members of Congress who are elected to do just that job. So, as you consider the nomination hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, here are a few things to recall. First, judicial philosophy. Every judge must possess some type of judicial philosophy. It's how they approach every case, and it is one of the most important things we should know before giving someone a lifetime appointment on the highest court in our nation. Second, specific doctrines like Chevron. When judges sometimes defer to an agency's interpretation of a statute, regardless of the text, and whether they think they will be overturned. Here, you may hear the common answer, well, this case may come before me, so I cannot answer. On specific cases, that is fine. But on broader questions of judicial philosophy, it's not as acceptable. The Senate and the American people deserve to know how someone who will hold a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court will approach the job. And third and finally, pending or upcoming cases. While commenting on them is normally inappropriate, senators are right to press on recusals where there might exist an already known conflict. As Judge Irving R. Kaufman once noted, the Supreme Court's only armor is the cloak of public trust, its sole ammunition, the collective hopes of our society. Thank each of you for being such an integral component of an enlightened electorate. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. Find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. And the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now less than a week away. The premier annual grassroots conservative event will be held this coming Friday and Saturday. That's April 1st and 2nd at the Penn Harris Hotel in Camp Hill. This year's featured speaker will be Fox News host, former Congressman Trey Gowdy. Former Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin will be the kickoff speaker. The conference will include forums spotlighting candidates for governor of Pennsylvania and for U.S. Senator. An added feature this year is a pre-conference election integrity summit to be held this Thursday, March 31st. As always, there will be speakers, panel presentations, and workshops. Complete information and registration for the 2022 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is available at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal, plugged into the pulse of Pennsylvania.